Hello, everybody. I'm Paul Menzel.
And I'm Jim Conlon, and we're the Old Dogs.
If you got about 20 minutes, grab a cup of coffee, pull up a chair, and join us.
In this episode, the Old Dogs ramble about aging with a friend. We track down an innocent pigeon who was accused of being a spy. We bring you another episode of I Saw It on the Boob Tube. We acquaint you with new words that have entered the English vocabulary. We present recent findings on the dangers of aging alone, and we marvel, on the other hand, of how superagers remain super. The Old Dog's conversation is with Dr. Michael Schaefer, who found his mission in providing facial reconstruction for children. Upon retirement, he started a new career by sculpting life-size horses from driftwood and other found objects. Stay with us. Paul, if I could look into your head, I might be able to see what's on your mind today.
So, yeah, well, that would be a scary voyage. I wouldn't recommend it. But I'll share with you what's on my mind. We have a pod nugget in our episode this week about the problem of aging alone. And what they suggested is a former relationship with a neighbor or a friend to mutually look in on each other.
Now, explain that a little more fully, okay, and make sure that we know what we're talking about here. We're forming a relationship with two like-minded, like-aged people. Is that it?
That's, I think, the idea.
Okay.
And also, we have to say that these people do not have family members, either close geographically or close emotionally, to perform that task. And so this is kind of a shift. You know, maybe a generation or two ago, the assumption was that you would take in your aging parents and they would live with you. Well, maybe that's three generations ago.
Oh, I don't know. It could have been. But
because our families are so spread out. This seems to be a possible alternative. What do you think?
Many of my friends, former and current, find themselves where they are because they moved considerably distant from their children and from their other relatives because of work. Maybe they have a spouse and the spouse passes away and then they are alone in a foreign city, so to speak. Yeah. And we don't realize that. Until
Well, you know, let's be honest. Our wives are likely to outlive us. I mean, that's statistically and the issue. But if it happens to them, it does concern us that we at least maybe talk about the subject. My problem is I'm not sure I have a close enough friend that I would suggest that relationship with. You know, it's my Minnesota nice coming out here.
Oh, yeah.
It's an imposition. You shouldn't do that to somebody.
Yeah. Oh, well, are you suggesting that we talk to our wives about this and suggest they start forming that kind of relationship with people?
Yeah, it's not our problem.
Yeah, I think about that when I look at my savings. Say, I don't have to worry about that. By that time, when they run out, I'll be long gone.
Okay, right. Yeah, but I that isn't what I was thinking about. You know, it's very possible that you and I might be the survivor. You know, we might be one of those super livers that they talk about. It's a problem that maybe we should think about, and possibly, and I know this sounds manipulative, but we might want to develop close enough relationships with people that the subject could come up.
I agree with that. And I see not directly.
So when are you coming over to take care of me?
You need taking care of. I got a few ideas.
Well, I need some discipline in my life.
Well, you know, PETA comes to mind.
The New York Times reported a case of suspected espionage by a feathered friend. Police in Mumbai, India, found a black pigeon loitering at a port where international vessels were docked.
The bird had a microchip and Chinese writing on its wings. India and China have a long history of provocative acts, so it was a natural conclusion that the pigeon was up to no good.
But lacking a suitable detention facility, the police turned to a veterinary hospital as a lockup. Once securely imprisoned, the police began their investigation of the pigeon.
The chip was sent to a forensics lab, and it turns out that chip was just location coding from where it came from. The Chinese writing on the pigeon's wings was too faded to decipher.
The conclusion was that the bird was a fugitive racing pigeon from Taiwan that had stowed away on a ship. So the bird was innocent. Now, this would normally be a happy ending, except the police forgot that the pigeon was still locked up.
Well, after 8 months, PETA India managed to gain the release of the pigeon, who was now free to resume lurking on the Mumbai docks. To date, there is no indication the pigeon intends to sue for false imprisonment.
Well, he needs a tough attorney.
Well, you know, when they start talking about detaining pigeons, I imagine that there's some grilling involved. For this segment of I Saw It on the Boob Tube, we go back to 1957. This sitcom featured a husband and wife who played a husband and wife who were movie stars living in Beverly Hills.
The show was a hilarious and stylish send-up of Hollywood in the 50s and all the obstacles to fame and fortune. Can you name the show and the two movie stars who played the two movie stars? We'll be back later with the answers. Dictionary.com has added or updated more than 1,700 words to their online lexicon. They perform this update twice a year to, as they say, support a greater understanding of where language is and might go next.
So let's take a look at some new additions so that we slip them into our conversation and appear bussin', an adjective which means great, wonderful, or amazing.
Here we go. Bed rotting, a noun which is the practice of spending many hours in bed during the day, often with snacks or an electronic device.
Girl dinner, a noun, is a collection of snacks, such as small quantities of cold cuts, cheese, and fruit, constituting a modest meal for one.
Pretty privilege, a noun, is the social advantage that a person has by fitting into the beauty standards of their culture.
Greedflation, a noun, is a rise in prices due to corporate greed rather than market pressure or other economic factors.
Global boiling, a noun, is a non-scientific term for extreme heat events, especially in regard to public health.
And finally, bag holder, a noun, is someone who hangs on to an unprofitable investment rather than selling it at a loss, only to suffer a worse loss when it becomes worthless.
Now, if you find it a waste of time to keep up with our ever-expanding language, we suggest you are hopelessly mid, an adjective, meaning unimpressive or disappointing.
That's me, I guess. The Atlantic published an extract from a book titled The Other Significant Other. The author, Rhina Cohen, explored the growing number of seniors with no close family ties who are facing the challenges of growing old alone.
Even those seniors with a partner run the risk of outliving them and spending their last years alone. Sociologists are calling this group elder orphans, and their numbers are growing.
A nursing home or an at-home caregiver are possible solutions, but they can be expensive alternatives. There is another option for aging adults who are elder orphans. They can create a support system by relying on friends.
Granted, this setup has limits if the friends involved need care at the same time, but it can save money and prevent loneliness. Also, this relationship of mutual caregiving feels less like a burden and more like a partnership.
A 2020 AARP survey found that 10% of caregivers for adults were friends or neighbors. It's a trend that is likely to grow. Of course, caregiving among friends doesn't resolve all the problems older adults have to face toward the end of life.
But it is a promising alternative to being an elder orphan. In the words of that noted philosopher Bill Withers, we can all use a friend to lean on.
Here's the answer for I Saw It on the Boob Tube. The show was called Mr. Adams and Eve. It starred Howard Duff and Ida Lupino, who played a version of Howard Duff and Ida Lupino.
The show only lasted 2 seasons and could maybe claim to be the first reality TV show. Well, granted, the show was scripted, but then so-called reality shows are also scripted, aren't they?
Yep.
In a recent issue of the AARP Bulletin, a featured article was The 7 Secrets of Superagers. These folks are defined as having an age of 90-plus with memory, thinking skills, and zest for life intact.
So, even if you have read the article, we thought we would give you a short version so you could see how much you match up with these superheroes. Even if you don't match up, hey, it's okay. You'll likely forget about it shortly.
Here we go. Secret number 1. Superagers control their blood sugar and blood pressure through mediation or a healthy diet.
Secret number 2. Superagers talk to their friends a lot because connecting with others leads to less brain shrinkage in key areas.
Secret number 3. Superagers avoid stress and prioritize mental health to reduce the risk of dementia.
Secret number 4. Superagers prioritize sleep. I like that one. Because this is a time when your brain clears away toxic waste that is associated with Alzheimer's.
Secret number 5. Superagers protect their vision and hearing, which results in, again, a reduced risk of dementia.
Secret number 6. Superagers push themselves physically, which leads to greater mobility and balance.
And finally, secret number 7, Superagers exercise their brains with challenges like crossword puzzles and Sudoku games. They are also more likely to read, listen to music, travel, and attend lectures.
Paul, I think we could probably add a secret number 8. And
yeah.
That would be to avoid reading things that you don't want to know about.
Yeah, I like that one.
Michael Schaefer's career was in plastic surgery. His favorite patients were children in need of facial reconstruction. For over 20 years, Michael made trips to many countries around the world, donating his services to kids who needed them. One day, by chance, Michael took a walk on a beach and discovered a plentiful resource of driftwood, which gave him the idea to create fantastical structures of horses, animals whose majesty and strength had captured his imagination since boyhood.
I'd like to start by asking you, what motivated you to become a doctor?
Well, Paul, that's quite easy. All of my growing up years, I was really interested in animals and nature and those kinds of things. And as I got into high school and college, I thought, I really need to satisfy my soul, to do something that I feel like is the closest to matters of life and death. My dad was in the grain business. He had was part owner in a country elevator, a wheat elevator, and a feed and grain business. And I loved him so much, I thought, well, I should follow in his footsteps. And so the first 2 years of my college, I went to Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas. Then I got home for summer vacation after my sophomore year in college, and my mom and dad said, Michael, what would you think about going to Notre Dame University? And I'm dyed-in-the-wool Catholic, grew up in a little town in western Kansas. And at that time, Notre Dame University was just one tiny level below the Vatican in terms of esteem in the Catholic Church. So I thought, oh my gosh, what an opportunity. So I did. I decided to do that. And this is how easy it was then and how compared to how hard it is now. I just wrote them and made an application and got in without much to do. And at that time, I really started thinking about what do I want to do with my life. And I knew that I didn't want to stay in the feed technology or the livestock feed business, much as I had grown up with it. And I thought, now is the time to switch. So I switched into pre-medicine as a curriculum, and thinking that that is about the closest thing that I can think to do that deals with matters of life and death. So I graduated with a pre-med degree and then went on to medical school. So it didn't have any real extravagant or exotic reasons, but other than just I knew I had to do something other than just out of keeping with my inner soul.
Right. Matters of life and death. That could have been selling insurance, Michael.
It could have been driving race cars. It could have been. I know, but that was my Western Kansas way of thinking. And ironically, if you don't mind me bringing this in, I had an experience later on that just brought that to life, or brought that to fore. I was moonlighting in a hospital outside Chicago during my residency, and I was called to pronounce a woman dead who had just died from bleeding after cancer surgery, and I pronounced her dead. And the next moment, I got a call from the nursery to come deliver a baby.
Well, there was a moment, Michael, when you really got your focus, it seems. You specialized in reconstructive surgery and had a lot to do in the lives of children, not only in this country, but elsewhere. Tell us about that leap that you took to get to that place.
Well, Jim, it really wasn't a leap. It was a cobblestone by cobblestone stepwise progress. In medical school, I really loved internal medicine. I had a wonderful rotation on the internal medicine service, and I thought, oh, this could be kind of fun. And then I did a surgical rotation, and that was even more in keeping with my love of fixing things and making things work. So I decided then in my junior year in medical school to go into surgery. And then my senior year, I had a number of good surgical rotations, and then made me convinced that I would take a surgical internship. Some branch of surgery would be my life's work. And then I've always loved children, and I had a rotation on a pediatric surgery service and just loved that. So I thought, pediatric surgery. So you can see it's kind of narrowing down a little bit. And then during part of my training, I had the good fortune to be assigned to a plastic surgery service as part of my surgery training. And plastic surgery, we in that specialty call it the queen of the surgical services, because it kind of deals with the skin and its contents. So anyway, I ended up having a mentor. One of my professors was a plastic surgeon at the Children's Hospital where I had part of my surgery training. And I became so impressed with him and his work and his personality. I thought, I think that's what I'm going to do. So it was surgery first, and then plastic surgery, and then dealing with children. So that's kind of what led to pediatric plastic surgery. Then there was a subspecialty of that called craniofacial surgery, which is dealing mostly with birth defects of the head and face. It deals also with traumatic and the after effects of tumor problems of the head and face. But 80% of that field of expertise dealt with birth defects.
You did something else fascinating, Michael. You started sharing your talents internationally in third world countries. Could you tell us how that came about?
I got a call one day from a friend, actually, who was here in Houston. I was in Chicago all of this time. All of my practice years were in Chicago. So a friend that I had taken my board exams with was in Houston. He called and asked if I'd like to join a group of people. There were about 10 or 12 young plastic surgeons. We'd been in practice for 2 or 3 years. And we'd all had extra training and fellowships. And it was a kind of an elite group of people. Asked me if I'd like to join. So I did, and we became what was called the Icarus Club, because we had all flown a little too close to the sun in our surgical adventures and had our wings melted. But each of us had a Daedalus who had kind of pulled us out of the water and set us back on the right track. So this was an amazing study club. We met once a year. So a couple of years into this, the same friend, Bill Riley, called and said, he was taking a group to the Philippines to do cleft lip and palate surgery because there were so many kids there and so few resources. And so from then on, at least once a year, sometimes twice, we would go initially to the Philippines with this quite small group of 10 or 12 people or 15. And we were so ill-prepared in those early days, but it was a start. And that was the beginning for me, and that began my 20-some year sojourn of doing these overseas mission trips. So I've been to probably 12 or 15 countries over the course of my time. And the purpose was, as you mentioned, Paul, it was not only to do the surgery, but to teach and bring this surgery, these surgical techniques to the home countries as best we could.
So you stopped your regular practice 2001, is that right, in Chicago?
Yes.
But you continued doing this volunteer work after that, correct?
Yes, I did, Paul. It was just so wonderful to do. That's probably the hardest thing to give up, was that overseas mission trip, because you realize that in an hour or less, you change a kid's life in a place that might not have another opportunity to ever have that done. So I can't remember exactly. I think my last overseas trip was in 2006 or 8. I can't remember exactly. But I was having trouble with my hips and knees. I had hip and knee joint replacements in between, interspersed in that time period. So I was becoming a little more limited in how I could handle these trips as well.
Well, you certainly didn't give up being creative. Tell us about your horses.
Well, about 25 years ago, Ellen and I were on the other side of Lake Michigan with some friends, and I started picking up driftwood. It was just a wonderful array of interesting-looking driftwood. And these friends, who knew me very well, said, "Ellen, are you going to let him take that stuff home? And, you know, he just collects stuff. and it'll be in his workshop or in your backyard for a long time." She said, "Well, if he hasn't used it by the end of the summer, we'll have a bonfire and weenie roast, and we'll have you over for it." So with that threat hanging over my head, one day, I've always had a workshop. Even when I was in practice, I had a workshop in my basement of my home, or I'd run a little shop somewhere. I've always been kind of loved fixing things and making things from nothing. In fact, I'd started a number of mental little galleries called the Something from Nothing Gallery, which I would make something from nothing, which was a good part of the practice I had. My surgery practice was making a nose when there wasn't one, or creating an eye socket where there hadn't been, that sort of thing. So I started putting that wood together, and I thought, well, I think I'll make a horse. So I made this horse, and I took it home a couple weeks later to show it to Ellen. I said, "Michael, that looks like a Deborah Butterfield." Well, Deborah Butterfield is a world-renowned sculptress of horses. Hmm. Well, I had no idea who Deborah Butterfield was. I said, "Oh, really?" And then people would come into the house and say, "Ellen, where did you get that Deborah Butterfield?" I said, "Well, actually, that's not Michael made that." So that started my odyssey of making horses out of driftwood and discarded materials, mostly wood. I sold about probably 15 of them in the Chicago area while we were there. Anyway, they're all over the country.
You have some mobility issues, Michael, but you seem to lead a very full life. What keeps you going?
Well, I'm fortunate, I think, to be interested in things. I'm still curious. I love doing things. I have to admit, there are things now that I think, well, maybe I just have to give that up. It is difficult. I use a cane now, and Ellen's my crutch on the other side most places we go. And I regret that. It does slow me down. But the rest of me is still pretty functional, and I love being part of my life and having the people in my life that I do.
Like what you've been hearing? How about sharing the joy with your friends? We can always use more listeners. There are more episodes on the way, so stay tuned and keep howling at the moon.